This book contains a very wide variety of topics. In the beginning, Nagarjuna starts talking about how to create the causes for good rebirth and how to create the causes for liberation. So liberation or awakening are our ultimate goals, the highest good. But in order to attain them, we're probably going to need many lifetimes. And so in order to have many precious human lives like we have right now, so that enable us to practice, then we'll need to create the causes for these good lives. And so he talks about ethical conduct, generosity, and so on. So he goes back and forth, you know, between these two topics for basically the first two chapters. And then he talks about how to create the causes for the signs of a Buddha, the 32 physical signs of a Tathagata. And he explains how to create the causes for those. He goes into a lot about how, you know, along that line of how to create the merit for a good rebirth and so on. He talks about how to govern wisely, you know, and to take care of the citizens and to have parks where the families can go and to aid the travelers and to have a good infrastructure, you know, in the society so goods and services can move. He goes into a big section about the body and the nature of the body and the disadvantages of being attached to our bodies, because our bodies are basically a bunch of recycled goo. Yeah, I mean, you think if you piled up, you know, a sperm and an egg and then all the food you ate, yeah, mixed it all together and then made a body. Okay. So our body is not so gorgeous. Yeah, we think it is. But on the inside, Okay, so he talks about that. He talks, you know, more about royal policy, how to choose good ministers for your government, how to choose even military leaders, how to treat people who have broken the law, how to run the prisons so that people are not punished severely. Sometimes I give a talk, and not tonight, because this is a more general talk about the book, but I've given talks before, you can find them on the web, on Nagarjuna's recommendations for leaders, on, you know, how to govern properly. And I've been wanting to send this to dear Donald, you know, because he really needs some help. And it's amazing what Nagarjuna in second century said that applies today. Yeah, and it would be good, at least in my country, if some of the politicians knew some of this. Yeah, like, well, I won't get into it. But if you've been reading what goes on in the U.S., it's quite amazing these days. Then he, in the last, it's very interesting, in the last verse of the penultimate chapter, he says, okay, I've taught you how to create the causes for a good rebirth. I've taught you how to govern. I've taught you how to realize the nature of reality. And if you can do this as a king, fantastic. But if it's too much for you to do as a king, then ordain. I could just hear, you know, the king going, ah. Yeah. And then in the chapter after that, he starts out talking about 57 faults that we have to overcome in order to become a Buddha. So he talks, it's different than the Abhidharma listing. It has some overlap with it, but also some difference of the kinds of afflictions that we need to eliminate. And then he goes into this incredibly inspiring description of the 10 bodhisattva bhumis, or the 10 grounds of bodhisattvas, and how bodhisattvas practice and the kind of qualities they develop. And it's so inspiring because it gives you this vision of the kind of person you can become, you know. And then he talks about the Buddha's qualities, again giving us this amazing vision of what we have the potential to be. Because, and I think this is valuable, because so often in our life we just think, I'm just little old me, and I gotta get up in the morning and have my Milo and my noodles, and I go to work, and the best I can hope for is maybe to get a promotion and a raise, and maybe I'll have good children, but who knows what you're really going to get. You know, it's total potluck when you have a kid. You don't know. You know, a stranger's moving into your house for the next 20, 30, or 40 years, and, you know, you have no idea what they're going to be like. And then, you know, okay, I'll raise my family, then I retire, then I do, what do I do after I retire? Maybe I play golf. Yeah, maybe I take art classes. Maybe I do some volunteering, and then I die. And often, you know, when we think about our future, that's what we think of. But when you learn the Dharma, you begin to see, wow, you know, we have a potential, a human potential, that is so much bigger than all of that. You know, when you think, you know, just think for a minute, you have the potential to work with your mind so that you never get angry again. Think about it. No matter what somebody says to you, no matter what they do to you, you have the potential to totally have a peaceful mind. Not because you're repressing your anger, not because you're ignoring something, but because you have the right view of reality. Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah? We have the potential to have equal-hearted care and concern for each and every living being, so that when we saw a living being, instead of thinking, oh, who's this guy? Can I trust them? And reacting with suspicion, or maybe, oh, there's somebody, I wonder what they can do for me. Okay, so instead of always relating to everybody based on can they help me or harm me, you know, we have the potential to generate a mind of love and compassion, of metta and karuna, whereby whoever we meet, we just automatically want them to be happy and be free of suffering, and we act in a way to bring that about. Wouldn't that be nice? Okay, so I think, you know, hearing about the qualities of bodhisattvas, the qualities of Buddhas, gives us that kind of vision of our human potential. And we really need to pay attention to it and have a lot of self-confidence so that we can go in that direction and make our lives very meaningful. So I wrote down, you see my notes, a few verses that I thought I would read to you to give you a sampling of some of the kinds of things that Nagarjuna talks about and that my teacher, Kensurjan Tekcho, gives the commentary on. Okay, so he's going to start out talking about higher rebirth and highest good. Highest good meaning liberation and awakening. Okay, so verse 4 says, here we maintain that higher rebirth is happiness, and the highest good is liberation. In brief, the method for attaining them is summarized as faith and wisdom. Okay, so higher rebirth is happiness within cyclic existence, and the method to attain it, he abbreviates here, he summarizes here as being faith. And here, faith means confidence in the law of karma and its effects. Okay, it doesn't mean blind faith in the Buddhist teachings. It means having an awareness that our actions have an ethical dimension and they produce results that we ourselves will experience. You know, principally the kind of rebirth we will take and what kind of experiences we will have in future rebirths. And then the second thing, the highest goodness, is liberation, total freedom from samsara or cyclic existence. And the method for attaining that is summarized as wisdom. Here, referring to the wisdom that knows the ultimate nature, yeah, which is translated the term as no self or non-self or selflessness, yeah, or emptiness. Okay, so here he's condensed most of the path in four lines. Yeah. In verse 5, he says, due to having faith or confidence in karma and its effects, one relies on the practices, meaning the ethical practices and also the other kind of virtuous actions that we do to create the cause for good rebirth. Due to having wisdom, one truly understands. What do we understand? The nature of reality. Yeah. Who we really are, or rather, in Buddhism, who we really aren't. Yeah. When we're in our late teens and early 20s, we're usually trying to figure out who we are. In Buddhism, we're trying to figure out who we aren't, because we have so many preconceptions of who we are based on superficial qualities. I am this nationality, this ethnicity, this religion, this gender, this sexual orientation, this socioeconomic class, this educational level, this career, you know, this race. All the time we have so many identities, many of them just based on our body. And then we really believe this is who we are. And then if somebody insults our identity, we get really upset. And we make our identities very rigid, you know. I am, okay, yeah. I am an American, therefore you should treat me like this, because I'm the citizen of a superpower. Okay? Yeah. Or we develop all sorts of identities, you know. I went to this school, I have this career, therefore you should treat me like this. I make so much money, you should treat me like this. Okay? Do you have some identities like that? Maybe a few. Yeah. And we think that's who we are, but we aren't any of those identities. We aren't any of them. They're just conventional things. Yeah. That apply for a short time in this life, based on conventional factors, but none of them are who we are. Okay? So it does us a lot of good when we start stripping away these false identities. Then we are not nearly as ego-sensitive to things. Okay. So if these two, the confidence in karma and its effects, and wisdom and reality, of these two, wisdom is foremost, but confidence must come first. So wisdom is foremost because that's what liberates us, and that's our ultimate goal, to attain nirvana. But in order to attain nirvana, we need to have a series of good rebirths so that because we have to create lots of causes for nirvana. So to attain those good rebirths, we need confidence in karma and its effects. Okay. Then I'm going to skip a bunch of verses. By the way, this particular text has a lot of verses that when you read other treatises, they often quote the verses in this text. Yeah. So if you've read, you know, different commentaries and seen citations, then you read this text. Oh, there it is. I remember this citation. So verse 80 is one of them. These very famous verses. Okay, so this is talking about who we are, or rather, who we aren't. The person is not earth, not water, not fire, not wind, not space, not consciousness, and not all of them together. What person is there other than these? So we have this identity of, here I am this real person. But if we start to ask ourselves, what really am I? Am I my body? Am I my mind? Okay, if we try and find this real person, seems to be there, it kind of eludes us, you know? So if we think I am my body, then we have to ask, which part of my body? So from the ancient way of looking at physics, yeah, there's five elements: earth, water, fire, wind, and space. Yeah. So earth is hardness, fire is heat, water is cohesion, wind is motion, and space is space. Okay. So in our body, we have all five elements, all five qualities. Are any of those five elements us? Am I the earth element in my body? If you took everything that's hard in my body and piled it up, is that me? If you took everything that is hot and piled it up, is that me? Or anything that is wet, that me? Anything that moves. If we look, we can't really find anything in our body that we say, that's who I am. There's just a lot of qualities, a lot of parts. There's no person there. So what about in our mind? Yeah. Maybe on my consciousness. Then, am I the consciousness that sees, that hears, smells, tastes, touches, thinks? Oh, maybe I'm the consciousness that thinks. Then which thought am I? And who thinks anyway? Yeah, who in the world is doing thinking? So when we look to try and find out exactly who this person is that we believe we are, we can't find it either in the parts alone, or even if we bring all the parts together in a collection, none of them are the person. This doesn't mean that there's no person, because clearly we're here. Yeah. And we use the word I, we use the word you, but those are conventions. For ease. Yeah. There is no soul or self in any of us, no inherent essence that makes us some unique person. Okay. It feels like there is, but when we search to find it, it just kind of evaporates or hides. So this, you know, leads into showing us the nature of reality. Basically, you know, a short explanation is that things appear to exist with their own inherent nature or essence. But when we examine them, we can't find out what they are. So things appear one way, but the way they appear is false. Okay. What's this? Come on. Cup. Everybody agree it's a cup? Yeah. Anybody think it's a grapefruit? Anybody think it's a giraffe? No. It's a cup. It looks like it has the nature of cupness in it, doesn't it? Like any idiot who walked in this room should know it's a cup. Right? But what really can you point to and say it's what the cup is? Is the cup the rim here at the top that you drink from? Is the cup the handle? Is the cup the cylinder part on the side? Is it the bottom? Yeah. What exactly is this cup? It looks like there's a real cup here. But if I dropped it, then there's going to be a whole bunch of pieces Where's the cup? Yeah, where did the cup go? It looks so real, doesn't it? Doesn't it look real? But we can all, I won't drop it. But imagine I do, and who knows, I might, but accidentally. But then where did the cup go? Okay, so what we're getting at is things appear to have some independent or inherent existence. But when we examine, we find out they don't have that type of essence. But that doesn't mean they don't exist. They exist, but they exist dependently. Yeah, this is one of the Buddha's big slogans. If you want to, if the Buddha had a brand, okay, you know, everybody has to have a brand these days. The Buddha's brand would be dependent arising. Yeah? Because Buddha would say, oh, yes, the cup is empty of essence, but it exists dependently. Yeah. Depends on causes, conditions, parts, and our mind that puts the parts together and creates the object and gives it a name. Okay? So independent existence is false. Dependent existence is how things exist. Okay? So that gives you, again, a little bit of feeling for when he starts talking about the ultimate truth. This, that part of the book, when I was working on it, was like electrifying for me, you know? It was just magnificent, you know? Really getting into it. And there was one example that my teacher, you know, I had heard many times in different teachings, and then he gave it here, and somehow, does that ever happen to you? You hear something in teachings many times, and then you hear it one more time, and all of a sudden you go, oh, wow, is that what they were saying? Yeah? So it was like, oh my goodness, that's what that example means. Whoa, I never realized that before. Yeah? You know, those moments where you kind of go, aha, yeah. Okay, then, okay, so then Nagarjuna starts to talk about, how to create good karma and how to abandon bad political actions. Okay? So here's what he says. If you wish to make your foes unhappy, do away with your faults and enhance your good qualities. That way you will gain great benefit and your enemies will also be displeased. You know, usually when we have an enemy, somebody we don't like, we want to harm them. We want to make them unhappy. We think, oh, if I beat this person up, then, you know, I've inflicted suffering on them. Okay. Nagarjuna says, that doesn't really inflict much suffering. If you really want to make your enemy unhappy, yeah, if you really want to make your foes unhappy, do away with your own faults and enhance your good qualities. Because if we do away with our own faults and abandon them, and we enhance our own good qualities, then, yeah, we'll be able to do a lot of good in the world. People will praise us. Our enemies will be so unhappy. You know, they wanted to harm us, and here we are doing something in the world that's beneficial. We've overcome our faults, and our enemies are totally stuck. They can't make us unhappy anymore. Are you getting what he's saying? I think it's kind of humorous, isn't it? Because that way you will gain great, great benefit, and your enemies will also be displeased. So this is a verse I want Trump to read. You know, do away with your faults and enhance your good qualities. That's the way you'll get rid of your enemies. Please do not tweet them and tweet all day and night insulting people. That doesn't do any good. Yeah. Better you abandon your own faults and gain good qualities. Yeah? I would love to teach Trump the Dharma. Yeah. You know what I do sometimes? Because many people write to me since the election. Yeah, and they say, what do? You know, we have a president who's a, you know, we're not sure about his mental health. Oh, seriously, very seriously, people have a lot of questions about his mental health. And they say, what are we going to do? You know, I mean, he's ruining the country. So one thing that I do to keep my heart open, yeah, is we do a lot of bowing, don't we? As Buddhists, we do a lot of bowing, a lot of prostrating. So when we do prostration practices at the Abbey, I visualize Trump, I visualize all the senators, all the Congress people, all the politicians all around me, and we're all bowing to the Buddha together. Yeah? Isn't that a great visualization? Can you imagine Trump's on the ground with his nose on the floor paying homage to the Buddha? You know? I mean, we've got to do this kind of practice. Bring our enemies, bring the people we don't like into our Dharma practice and imagine them creating virtue with us. Yeah? It's certainly better than slandering them and criticizing them and calling them names, isn't it? Yeah, you think I'm crazy? But really it works. It makes your mind very, you know, much more peaceful. So if you have, you know, a personal enemy or somebody who you think is driving you crazy, you know, put them next to you and around you when you're bowing to the Buddha. It really helps. Okay. Then Nagarjuna tells the king, be generous, speak gently, be beneficent. Act with the same intention that you wish from others. Through these actions, bring together the world and also sustain the Dharma. Okay? So, how do we sustain the Dharma? You know, in the world, how do we bring sentient beings together in harmony? And we certainly need this, don't we, in our world? Okay. Be generous. Yeah. Share. Give people things. Don't be stingy. Open your heart to them. So give material things. Give affection and love, give protection from fear, give the Dharma. Second, speak gently. So think before you speak. Speak truthfully, kindly, what will unite people and make them harmonious. Praise people for what they're good at. Even praising the people you don't like. You're going, I don't want to praise people I don't like. It's good for you. Really? Yeah. Because if you can see the good qualities in the people that you don't like, it frees you from having a rigid conception of them. It opens your mind to see that they're much more than one quality or one action that they did that you don't like. Be beneficent, so be kind to others. Yeah. When you're driving on the highway, let somebody come in the lane in front of you. What? What? Nobody's gonna come in front of me on the highway. Never will I give my place. Yeah, how many of you have road rage? Three people. How many of you are lying? Okay, so road rage is very dangerous. Very dangerous. Be beneficent. Somebody wants to come in front of you, it's fine. You'll arrive at your destination 1 second later. I was in a car once. My friend was having a baby. And she was in labor, and I was in the back with her, and the person driving was driving fast. Yeah. So just think, if somebody cuts you off on the highway, it may be because they're trying to get to the hospital because somebody's having a baby. Because you read, I've read so many news stories of babies being born in parking lots, or in cars on the highway because they can't get to the hospital in time. So they want to go in front of you, great. Yeah. Act with the same intention that you wish from others. Okay? So this is kind of like the golden rule. Yeah? Actually, I think the golden rule needs to be improved. Treat others better than you currently treat yourself. And treat yourself better than you currently treat yourself. So don't put yourself down so much. Don't criticize yourself so much. It's usually a bunch of rubbish. Okay. So through these actions, bring together the world and also sustain the Dharma. Okay, so then he goes into talking about speaking the truth. And it's amazing, throughout this book, many times he talks about speaking the truth. To speak the truth is to speak in a manner that is not deceptive. It is not what is in fact distorted by an intention. A statement is true by being of benefit to others. The other kind of statement is false since it is not beneficial. So what is the truth? The truth has to have two qualities. First, it's not deceptive. It's what we understand to be the facts. But it's not just that. It must be said with a beneficial intention. Yeah. saying what is factually accurate with an intention to harm someone is not what Nagarjuna calls the truth. Okay? Because sometimes we do that, don't we? Yeah. We're mad at this person, so we hurt somebody else, criticize them. So then we go to this person, and instead of saying, criticizing them directly, we say, so-and-so said this about you. And it's true that so-and-so said that about them. But we say it because we want to hurt this person's feelings. Yeah. From Nagarjuna's viewpoint, that is not the truth. Because we're acting with a harmful intent. Okay, then he talks about generosity. A single shining act of generosity hides the flaws of a king. Likewise, an instance of greed will contradict all of his good qualities. So this pertains to us, not just to kings. Yeah, but a single action of shining generosity, giving from our heart, giving with kindness, yeah, giving respectfully to someone, not just going, oh, here, it's yours. Not like that. Yeah, with both hands. Here, please accept this. Giving respectfully, giving with a kind intention, okay? If we do that, it hides a lot of our faults, yeah? Because everybody responds to generosity. Mm-hmm. Likewise, an instance of greed will contradict all your good qualities. So if there's another situation where we're being greedy, maybe we deceive somebody to get what we want, maybe we don't share what we have, maybe we're trying to get an extra share. But if people see us being greedy, they lose faith in us. This goes for people doing business also. I get asked so often in Singapore, yeah, how can you do business and tell the truth and practice the Dharma? If you tell the truth and you help your clients and customers, your business will prosper. Because the clients and customers will trust you. If you try and cheat them and get the best deal and lie and deceive, they will never come back and they will tell their friends to avoid you as well. If you treat them with kindness and fairness and you're responsible, they will come back and do business with you and they will tell their friends. So it's really true, you know. An act of generosity can really do a lot of good, and one act of greed can make people lose trust in us. And then he speaks about the importance of being tranquil. It is profound to be tranquil. For it is profundity, tranquility is highly respected. From respect comes glory and authority. Therefore, devote yourself to tranquility. Okay, so tranquility or peacefulness, the commentary says, is the result of being conscientious of your physical, verbal, and mental actions. And pacifying, disturbing, or superfluous actions of body, speech, and mind. Okay? So becoming tranquil means, yeah, introspective awareness and monitoring your actions of body, speech, and mind. Yeah. And then seeing what is it important to do and what is it not important to do. Okay? And here, if I can make a suggestion, because I've come to Singapore many years. So I first came in 1987, yeah, and almost every year since that, not quite every year, but almost. And I've noticed a change in the country since then, the last 30 years. People are much more stressed. Much more stressed. Yeah. And when you are stressed and you are rushing here, rushing there, I gotta do this and I've gotta do that, and I'm so stressed and this and that, that, boom. Yeah. Actually, you get much less done and you're a nervous wreck. So I think this advice of tranquility means, you know, observing your body, speech, and mind. And realizing that pressuring yourself and pressuring others doesn't really lead to accomplishing more. Sometimes it leads to accomplishing less because you're so stressed out that you don't do a good job, so you have to do it over again. Okay? And also, stress is not very good for our health. I have a friend who's a doctor, and he started writing prescriptions for people. So-and-so is only allowed to work 8 hours every day. Yeah, give this to your boss. Yeah. No overtime. No staying at the office until 8, 9, 10 o'clock. You have to, you know, be a happy, whole person, not a stressed out, crazy one, okay? So cultivate tranquility, yeah? If you're getting stressed, stop, come home to your breath. Remember loving kindness, okay? And another virtue he talks about is good wisdom. By being wise, your mind will not waver. Not dependent on the opinions of others, you will be steadfast, kind, and not deceived. Therefore, devote yourself to wisdom. Okay? So by being wise, your mind will not waver. Not dependent on the opinions of others. So when we're wise, we know how to think clearly. We can use reasoning, we can use common sense, we can base things on our own experience, but we know how to think clearly without being partial, without being emotional. Okay? Emotions are good, but some emotions make it difficult to think clearly. So some emotions we want to cultivate on the path, other emotions we want to let go of on the path. Okay, but if we have wisdom, we can discern between which emotions to cultivate, which ones to let go of. We can make wise decisions, we can make good choices. If we make good choices, then we have far less to regret. Yeah? So that breeds a lot of tranquility in our mind. And also when we have wisdom and we can look at things clearly, we can ask for help when we can need it. We can listen to other people's ideas and assess if they're helpful or if they're not helpful. But we will not be prone to peer pressure. and to doing things just to please people. Yeah. Because lots of times we may know in our heart a certain course of action is the Dharma way to do it, but somebody is pressuring us to lie or to get involved in a shady business deal or to get in, you know, involved in a faction at the workplace and speak badly against somebody else. If we have wisdom, we do not get involved in any of those things. And even if other people pressure us and say, well, what kind of person are you? You're not doing that. Yeah, you say, I'm fine. And this is especially, you know, when people want you to drink, they want you to gamble, yeah, and do all sorts of things that are not good for you and are not good for your family. Yeah. If you're receptive to peer pressure, then when your friends are drinking, you know, and you say, no, I don't want to drink, and they say, oh, are you some kind of, you know, prude? All these Buddhists, you think you're better than everybody else because you don't drink? Yeah. So then you start thinking, oh, maybe they're right. Maybe I am conceited. Oh, I better drink. Then they'll feel more comfortable with me. Pour the whiskey. Look, 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 look. You know? What's wrong with just saying, you know, I've drunk and I decided it's really not good for my physical health or my mental health. And I'm perfectly happy having grape juice or orange juice or whatever you drink. Yeah, what's wrong with that? If people don't like you because you refuse to drink, what kind of friends are they? If they can't respect your choices, are you sure they're friends? Yeah? So, you know, if we have wisdom, then we act ethically and we know what we're doing, and nobody can intimidate us or talk us into doing something we don't want to do. Then we really, that is so beneficial when we are clear-sighted like that. Because if every time somebody pushes us, you know, this one wants me to drink, this one wants me to gamble, this one wants me to do a shady business deal, this one wants me to, you know, go on a holiday but bill it all to my company, you know, and you do everything everybody else wants you to do, then you don't know who you are anymore. And all your ethical conduct is down the drain. And then you really feel guilty. Yeah. So better to learn how to think clearly. Yeah. It's a skill. Learn how to think clearly. Okay. But also learn to ask for help when you need it. Because he says here, wisdom and dharma always increase in someone who consults with those who are restrained in speech and pure, and possess undefiled wisdom and compassion. Okay? So when you need help, consult with somebody who is restrained in speech, who speaks what's truthful, what's beneficial, when it's appropriate. Think of, consult with somebody who has pure intentions, someone who has undefiled wisdom, who knows how to think clearly, and someone who has compassion. Yeah? If you ask for advice from those kind of people, and then think about the advice and make sure you understand it correctly, then you can benefit from it. Okay? I find lots of times people ask me for advice, and everything I say, they go, yes, but, and then tell me why they can't follow the advice. And then they say again, what should I do? And I give somebody some advice. And they say, yes, but, and tell me why they can't follow it. I give people two yes buts, and then I'm done. Yeah? And then I say, my advice does not seem to help you. What do you think you need to do? Yeah. You don't get three yes buts with me. Okay, two is enough, I think. Okay. So I wanted to leave. I didn't even get through my little list. But I think I gave you some taste of what's in the book. It's a wonderful book, yeah. And I really want to thank all the people at Pomenzu who sponsored the books. Many people donated to be able to purchase these books and ship them here. To be able to give them to you for free distribution. So we really have to dedicate for the long life and successful Dharma practice of all those people who are benefiting benefacting the books. You know, their kindness is really amazing. So if you take a book, yeah, please read it. If you're not sure that you want to read all of this, please don't take one. Leave it here for somebody who will read all of it. Okay? But if you take one, you have a commitment to read the whole thing. It's not hard reading. Yeah. But it is long. But that's okay. You get a lot of wisdom. Let me, okay, so I'm not counting the glossary and the index. So there are 394 pages of pure wisdom and compassion. Read this instead of the comic books. Read this instead of the magazines with all the all the advertisements telling you to buy things that you don't need. Okay, this book will help you a lot more. Okay, got it? Okay, so there's a little bit of time for a few questions. This is your time. Please don't all line up afterwards with your own individual questions. Yeah, because the people here need to, you know, close up. So if you have a question, probably other people have questions, some other questions, so please ask. Yes?
How can you manage to be so public to be able to produce a book by year?
How can you be able to
be able to produce one book by year for book lunch every year?
I am tired.
How is it you're so prolific as a writer? You're producing one book a year.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. This book was written recently. Some of the other books, like Approaching the Buddhist Path, that one, the rough draft was written a long time ago, and now I'm getting it in print. But it takes some concentration, and determination, but I don't know. It feels good to do it. It feels like I can contribute. So maybe that motivation is what enables me to go forward with it. Anything else?
Wonderful, thanks for the teaching. I was just wondering, after the teaching to the king, actually what happened to the king after he received the teaching?
What happened to the... what happened to the king? You know, we don't know whether he ordained or not. But I suspect that whatever advice he received, he put into practice. There's some very interesting verses in the book where Nagarjuna is speaking to this powerful king, and he says, I'm just a humble monk, you know, and you're the monarch of this great kingdom. So who am I to give you advice? But I care about you and I care about the citizens. And so please excuse me if I give you some advice. Because I know that a lot of your ministers and the other people around you, because they want to please you, they don't always tell you what you need to hear. Yeah. And so I'm going to say some things that you need to hear that may be difficult, but it's being said for your benefit. And then he starts, you know, explaining these different faults that have to be eliminated and how to govern the kingdom and all. So he's very skillful in that way. So I suspect that the king followed the advice. Yeah.
Another question is, I'm not sure whether I'm understanding you correctly. In general, in Pali canon, the emphasis is on the non-self and selflessness. And the emptiness concept only come later when Nagarjuna expounded the emptiness. Mm-hmm. Is it a later add-on concept or Nagarjuna trying to interpret the non-self and selflessness with emptiness?
I think the teaching on emptiness is just another way to read what is in the Pali Canon. There are two sutras that the shorter discourse on emptiness and longer discourse. But I think what Nagarjuna is doing is, because the verse I read to you about the person is not, you know, the four elements of consciousness, the same ideas in the Pali Canon. Yeah. So I think Nagarjuna is explaining it in a slightly different way than some of the earlier commentators did.
Just now we were talking visualizing when we are doing the prostration to the Buddha, we visualize our enemy or dear dog, prostration with us. So how does it benefit him, like when we visualize him prostration together with us? It seems like the benefit is more towards ourselves.
I think the benefit is more towards ourselves. But of course, if it benefits us by making us less judgmental and less critical, then that will benefit the other person because we'll be a lot nicer to them. Okay.
The concept of emptiness, the no I, is still very abstract to me. And I'm just wondering how do we proceed to meditate or contemplate on it so that I can really see what is really emptiness and have this breakthrough of no I? Know me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how do we do that? abstract idea, it's still concept, it's still
theory. Yeah. Okay. So it seems quite abstract. And actually it requires a bit of study. It's not going to come quick, cheap, and easy, so to speak. It requires some study. But just some interesting practical ways to do it are, you know, just when you're standing and waiting for something, look at the things around you and say, what is that? Yeah, you know, you're at the MRT station. And then you say, what's an MRT station? Yeah, can I find what the MRT station is? Is it the train tracks? Is it the floor of the station? Is it the train? Is it the signs above? Yes, I am at the MRT station. And if I say that term, people know what I'm talking about. But what really is it? And it's also very helpful to do this. What's very interesting is when you get angry, okay? Somebody criticizes you. And instead of focusing on them and what they said to you, say, who is angry? I'm angry. Who's angry? Who is the person that's angry? I say I'm angry, but on what basis do I say I'm angry? Who or what is the person that's angry? Can you find that person that's angry? Very interesting. Or if there's somebody that you're madly in love with and you think that they're wonderful, or some person that you really can't stand, okay, take the person you're madly in love with, yeah, and say, who is that person? Yeah? Are they their name? Are they their family? Are they one quality? Who actually is that person that I love? Yeah. Is it their hair that I love? If their hair were here? Yeah. Maybe their brain. I love their brain. So their brain's out here. Oh, I love you. Really? So very interesting. Who's the person you love? Similarly, the person you can't stand. Who is it? Yeah. Who is it that you can't stand? So this is just some interesting ways to kind of play with the idea. And then, you know, hear more teachings and think about them some more. Okay, so let's dedicate the merit now. Do we have a slide for the dedication? Okay, so we'll dedicate for the welfare of all sentient beings, and we'll rejoice in the merit we created, everybody here created. And let's especially dedicate for the long life and good Dharma practice of all the sponsors and benefactors of the books. Okay. And make prayers for Kenzo Jampa Techo. He passed away a few years ago. May he reappear on our planet. May we have the fortune to study with him again in the future. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore.